This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's been more than 2 months since U.S. Marines pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad's Al-Farda Square as they swept into the Iraqi capital. On Wednesday, April 9th, the mood was one of jubilation. It looked like liberation. The future seemed bright. That was then. Today, to many frustrated Iraqis, normalcy looks like a distant prospect. In many places, basic necessities like water, electricity, and medical care are still in short supply. Security remains a major problem. And as yet, there is no solution to the question of who or what will succeed Saddam. So today, we're going to talk to people who've been to Iraq recently to either assist or assess living conditions in that country. If you have questions about conditions in Iraq, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll start today's discussion in Baghdad with NPR's Ivan Watson. And it's always good to have you with us, Ivan. And I think we just may have lost Ivan Watson. That sounded like the sound of a telephone hanging up. Is that accurate? All right, we'll try to get him back on the line. And what we'll do in the meantime is speak with Ron Johnson, who is at Capitol Hill. He's RTI's Vice President for International Development. That's this spring, the U.S. Agency for International Development awarded $7.9 million to this nonprofit group, the Research Triangle Institute, to help in the process of reconstruction and develop local governance and administration in Iraq. And Mr. Johnson, I understand you just returned from Iraq a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. I got back about 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago today.
Who's in charge there now on the local level?
The city services are in the hands of essentially the technical department heads that have been working in those city services historically. It's not the top-level leadership because the top-level leadership is no longer working in those positions as a result of their previous membership in the Ba'athist Party. So it's generally 2 to 3 layers down in the technical department heads, and that's basically on the Iraqi side who's running services in the cities.
And what kind of services are we talking about here?
Well, these are the basic services that we typically associate with local government: sewer, water, streets, sanitation, solid waste collection, also the education system, health clinics, and so forth, traditional local government services.
Are these government services, is there money to pay these people to come to work every day?
The U.S. has started meeting the payroll. The initial payments are, of course, as you know from the news media, have been the emergency payments, and certainly in Baghdad, many of the employees are back at work, having received their emergency payments, and they're moving on to establishing regular payroll. As I understand it, although this is not, of course, in our project area, it has been slower to get these payments out and started in some of the cities around the country.
Now, of these various services, and we understand Iraq's a big country, Baghdad's a big city, and so this is going to vary from place to place, but can you characterize how well this is working right now?
Well, services in many of the cities, including Baghdad itself, deteriorated significantly over the last 10 to 15 years. Just to give you a concrete illustration, about 2 weeks ago, one of the sewage, there are 4 sewage treatment plants in the city of Baghdad, and one of those 4 sewage treatment plants was brought back up online just about 3 and a half weeks ago. That's the first time that sewage treatment plant has worked in Baghdad in over 10 years. So a good deal of the service problems are associated with deterioration of the infrastructure over a long period of time, not something that just happened catastrophically during the March, April, early May time frame.
Now,
it varies a great deal.
It does vary a great deal. And before that sewage treatment plant was up, I take it, then raw sewage was just being pumped into the Tigris River.
It has been for many years, and it continues to, because the sewage treatment plants, even with all of them operating, are not adequate to the task of treating all of the effluent in the city of Baghdad. And that would be even truer in many cities in the south, where the previous regime significantly neglected local services in the south part of the country.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of your goals is to develop neighborhood and community leadership. How do you go about doing that?
Well, it's interesting. We weren't sure exactly how receptive people in the neighborhoods would be to beginning to get organized, because, of course, organizing politically was something that was absolutely not done in the previous regime. I mean, that's literally, you could be shot for that. What we found, even before we got there, just following the news media, and as soon as we got there, we found the neighborhood groups are very much organizing themselves. Typically, it's to deal with immediate problems like public safety, keeping the looters out of the neighborhood or picking up the garbage in a neighborhood. And so even the military, when they first switched from a warfighting stance to their civilian activities, immediately found many neighborhood groups organizing. And we found the people in the neighborhoods very receptive to stepping up and playing a role and giving voice to their frustrations.
And giving voice to frustrations, we've heard a lot about Iraqi resentment.
You know, I think that speaking for our experience on the ground there, the resentment is more at the situation than it is than it's identified specifically with the U.S., whether it's U.S. civilian or U.S. military. We found them very receptive to us. We've also observed them being very receptive to the work of the U.S. military civil affairs officers. But obviously, there's a great deal of frustration, and the electricity is not on. It's not on, and it doesn't matter whose fault it is. It's a frustrating situation.
You've done similar work to this in other countries, El Salvador, Indonesia. This would seem to be a different order of magnitude.
Well, we have worked with in Indonesia, for example, with over 100 local governments, but never on this scale and with this many activities at the same time. So, yes, it is a different order of magnitude, although in many ways the nature of the work is not dissimilar to what we've done in other countries.
Well, Ron Johnson, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ron Johnson is Vice President for International Development at the Research Triangle Institute, and I believe we now have Ivan Watson back with us on the line from Baghdad. And Ivan, we apologize for the mix-up there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're dealing with satellite phone technology here.
And it, like every other service, it seems, in Baghdad, sometimes spotty. I know that you've been reporting on a story about an issue that most of us take for granted in Baghdad. It's become quite a problem, and that is garbage, trash removal.
Right. Well, I've met the American official who's been put in charge of the waste disposal in this city. And a man who had experience in the Army Corps of Engineers working in the Caribbean after hurricanes and trying to deal with hiring contractors in this city and trying to basically clean up the trash in the city and take control of this service and dealing with a lot of corruption on a day-to-day basis. In fact, he had established a new landfill about a half hour's drive outside of Baghdad and was dealing with hundreds, if not thousands, of trucks that were delivering sand instead of garbage. It was much easier to pick up sand from the side of the road and dump it there and then get paid for a load of what was supposed to be garbage. So a lot of corruption that he was dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Now, what is the problem of trash? Tell us about the quality of civic administration in Baghdad.
Well, I've been kind of asking around, and I wouldn't say that trash is the number one complaint that people have. You do see garbage kind of piling up in some of the streets. You have seen some sanitation workers cleaning up some of this as part of this program. It is the largest program, public works program in Baghdad right now, run by the American administration here at about $200,000 a year, according to the American administration. But again, the biggest complaints here would be electricity, security, medical services, and being paid your salaries. A lot of these people worked for the government in some shape or form, and they say they have not been paid their salaries.
Well, let's get some listeners involved here. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. And let's go to Adrian, who joins us from Southfield, Michigan.
Hi. I'm calling because we've already been in there for, the conflict basically ended at the end of April. And a month or 6 weeks or 8 weeks is a very long time for people to be going without fresh water and electricity. And I just have to think about the kind of natural disasters that we've had in the U.S. and that people here would never put up with being without basic facilities for that long. And I'm wondering why it's taking so long to repair these facilities in Iraq as opposed to here, besides the fact that, you know, it's Iraq and we don't have maybe the same infrastructure set up there. But it seems unreasonable to expect people to wait this long and then wonder why they're not welcoming us with open arms.
Ivan, could you hear that?
I could, and you're right. People are very frustrated, and I think that frustration and that resentment with how long it's taking for life to get back to normal, it's rising every day. I have not met a single person here who has not said that, hey, I lived better 3 months ago, 4 months ago than I do now. At least then, I had electricity. I had running water, and I didn't worry about somebody carjacking me in the streets of the capital city.
Exactly. So, I mean, is anyone in the administration prepared to answer this kind of question?
Well, the answer that we're hearing is that people are working. There are very good people, very people with the best intentions that are working within the civil administration here, and they really are trying hard, and it's a risky job. There are attacks going on here. People have to wear flak jackets and helmets to do work in this area. But I think the sense that you get from people on the streets is that that the occupying force, the U.S., when it came in here, it simply was not prepared for the monumental task of not just running a capital city of 4 to 5 million residents, but running an entire country and just picking up where the last government left off and starting all over again. That they just simply did not have the numbers and the resources to bring things up to speed that quickly. And that's where a lot of this resentment is coming from. Many Iraqis will tell me they were happy to see Saddam Hussein go, and they were happy to see American forces arrive, but they just don't understand how come life cannot get back to normal faster.
Adrian, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, Neil.
Let's go now to Mike, and Mike is on the line with us from Baltimore, Maryland.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if maybe some of the resentment is compounded by the fact that there may have been many, many Iraqi soldiers and a significant number of Iraqi civilians killed during the conflict. And I have just, in the American media, found no information.
I'm sorry, Mike, we lost that last part?
I've heard no information in the American media about the numbers or estimated numbers of Iraqi soldiers or civilians that might have been killed during the conflict. And I was wondering if somebody who knew with the situation in Iraq now might have some idea of what those figures might have been, and if they were significant, that might also explain the resentment coming so quickly when the quality of life issues aren't being resolved also.
Ivan, are there any reliable figures that you're aware of?
I haven't seen any of these figures. There definitely were civilian victims. There were soldiers who were killed. I know families who lost relatives in some of the fighting that took place. I can also say, though, that unlike 1991, when there was another bombing that took place for weeks, in this conflict, many Iraqis did feel safer. They realized very quickly that they were not targets, that it was government buildings predominantly that were being hit. And outside of Baghdad, what I've heard from people is that they did feel safer, the risk of being part of the collateral damage, as they say, it wasn't nearly as high as what they'd experienced more than a decade before in the first Gulf War. And there were definitely significant efforts to preserve Iraqi infrastructure, bridges and the power stations and the sewage treatment plants. And the irony is that many of these installations were destroyed not during hostilities, but after the fact.
Well, because of the problems with satellite telephones, we're going to have to pick up with Ivan after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Baghdad is a city with foreign soldiers, foreign journalists, and very little homegrown governance. Today we're talking about Baghdad and Iraq, 9 weeks after the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime. If you have questions about the basics of life there, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. If you know somebody who's been to Iraq for whatever reason in the past 2 months, we'd like to hear from you. 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And NPR's Ivan Watson was wrapping up his comments as we ran out of time coming up onto the break there. And Ivan, I apologize for cutting you off like that, but I know you wanted to finish what you had to say.
That's quite all right. Basically, we did see that U.S. forces tried to preserve, safeguard much of the infrastructure of this country, and ironically, much of it has been destroyed after the main hostilities by the looting that is still going on today.
And is there more guards at significant public facilities to protect those buildings from being destroyed by looters?
Well, you really do have a significant American military presence everywhere, especially here in the center of the country, on the streets. But as I saw just two or three days ago, driving north from here, past an installation that had been protected by American forces that had for some reason pulled out, it was some kind of a warehouse, within the 12 to 24 hours after the American forces had pulled out, residents, neighbors had just poured into this place and were literally taking it apart. And it was on a highway that American military convoys were passing back and forth. You could see some convoy every 5 to 10 minutes passing right by this this site of obvious looting.
NPR's Ivan Watson joining us from Baghdad, and we know it's late there. We appreciate it, Ivan.
Thank you, Neil.
Ivan Watson will be reporting later today on All Things Considered, more on the situation of collecting trash in Baghdad, so you'll want to stay tuned to this NPR member station for that. The humanitarian aid organization CARE has worked in Iraq since 1991. CARE workers focus on improving the quality of life in poor communities. Since the war, that work has intensified. Joining us now is Anne Morris, Director of Operations for CARE in Iraq. She's with us by phone from Baghdad, and also it's certainly just as late where you are. We appreciate your taking the time.
Thank you.
A big focus of your work is the sanitation system and the water supply. What are conditions like now?
Well, I think after so many years of sanctions, the very sophisticated and old water supply system has certainly been completely disrupted. We're currently working in as many governorates as we can, including in Baghdad, to restore and maintain the quality and quantity of water supply. For the sewage system, much of that infrastructure that was about to be replaced has been looted. The previous speaker was completely correct in that. And these systems are massive, and they're custom built in foundries, and it takes many, many months to build them. So the potential problems from a public health perspective are very serious.
How long would it take, is it going to take, to improve the situation?
Well, it's the summer months now. The evaporation from the river coming out of Baghdad is obviously accelerating. The sewage that's flowing into the river, which did before the war, will become less diluted and more concentrated. So we would expect to see more waterborne disease because of that. Whether it's typhoid or cholera, is not really the point. The increase in diarrheal disease is already evident in some of the poorer communities in the peri-urban areas of Baghdad, which service the poorer parts of the community. People, women I've spoken with in focus groups tell me all of the children in their households are suffering with diarrhea at the moment.
Is there, well, we'll talk about this also in more detail later, but is there are there supplies to rehydrate them and medicine to deal with their problems?
Yes, there are. I mean, we've put in a lot of health supplies into the hospital system and primary health care system, and CARE has been working here, obviously, for a long time. Also, jointly with UNICEF, the oral rehydration solutions are available and stocked in the main central supplies. But then again, when you, in the aftermath of a war, when a government has collapsed and the main structures that would have worked with the Ministry of Health have collapsed, it's very difficult to provide the normal distribution systems that would have existed under the previous government.
Our next caller is Cynthia, who's on the line with us from Vernon, New York.
Hello.
Hello.
It was good to hear Anne. And before I give my question, I'd just like to remind you and all the listeners that under the Geneva Accords, the occupier country has responsibility for the law and order and security in the occupied country. Now, the specific question I have is this. Actually, three of us went over to see Anne at CARE several weeks ago. And on our way, we discovered all of this unexploded ordnance in many parts of the city. Now, this unexploded ordnance is not only killing the Iraqi people, it is killing our soldiers, too. And it needs to be dealt with. We observed it, and we say that that is an emergency issue that the American troops must deal with. They don't even have the yellow caution tape around many of the dangerous areas, and they must have it written in Arabic, not only in English.
Ann Morris, what can you tell us about that?
Well, I can say that that is correct. There is an enormous amount of UXO in the city of Baghdad. I believe there are units that are specially tasked to destroy safely that hazard, and that many people have been injured by this. And it's correct that under international humanitarian law and the law of occupation, that it is the responsibility of the coalition to assist in the safekeeping of the civilian population. But at the same time, we, in our old office, we had a 500-pound bomb next door, and two doors down from our office. It hasn't been destroyed yet because obviously you can't just blow it up. It's far too big and it will create a lot more damage.
It must create some anxiety as well.
Yes, we moved.
Okay. Well, Cynthia, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
And Ann Miller, again, thanks very much for your time. It's quite late in Baghdad. Excuse me. Ann Morris is director of operations for CARE in Iraq, and she spoke with us from Baghdad. Another big concern, as we mentioned earlier, is the state of medical care in Iraq. Dr. Lim Amowitz is a doctor with Physicians for Human Rights, and she joins us now. She went into Iraq as U.S. troops moved into that country and was there until just a few weeks ago. Dr. Amowitz joins us by phone from her home in Providence, Rhode Island. She leaves tomorrow to return to Iraq, and thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
What were conditions like when you were last there?
When I was last there, we were traveling mostly in the south, and the conditions of the hospitals were improving slowly. However, security and looting was still going on. There were lots of windows that were missing. People were looting even the electrical wires out of hospitals and clinics, anything that they could gather besides the medicines.
Now, obviously, your information is a couple of weeks old. I'm sure you stay in touch with it, though.
I do.
And is it improved, do you know?
It's sort of stabilized. It hasn't completely improved, although the medical supplies are improving, and improving more so for the maternity clinics, as there has been some identification that there was not a supply of medicines, particularly for women.
Now, you spent a fair amount of time in various places, Najaf, Nasiriya, Baghdad. Can you describe, you know, obviously it's a big country, different places. Is it the same everywhere?
It is not the same everywhere. The south is much poorer than the central areas of Baghdad, and you tend to see more mud huts, people living among sewers or runoff of sewers that aren't working currently. You see kids playing in these puddles of raw sewage, and it's very different in the south than it is in Baghdad. Baghdad is much more urbanized.
We have an email question from Gene Smith in Madison, Alabama. There was much made of American surgeons treating Iraqi combatants during the war. Have we moved medical teams into the cities to help staff the hospitals, which seem to have been staffed by Ba'athists?
The hospitals are actually well-staffed physician-wise. It's the nurses that are a problem. Because of the security situation, female nurses are not coming in, and they were already at a very low staff rate to begin with. One of the other things that I think people don't understand is that the Iraqi physicians are highly trained. Many of them were trained in Western areas during the 70s and early 80s as they were doing their subspecialty training. So this is a highly trained, capable group of people. It's what you need is more of the infrastructure and supplies.
Let's get a phone call now from Summer, who joins us from Overland Park in Kansas.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I talk to my family a lot, and as I understand from what's going on, they are really having faith in Paul Bremer and think he's doing a good job at the moment, and you can see some improvement every day, as they say. But still, regarding the safety of people going out in the evening, by 6 o'clock, everyone has to be home.
Hmm. Summer, your family is in Baghdad?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
And then what's happened at the moment is most of the family from the neighborhoods. Actually, my family and the neighborhoods, they stay outside almost all the night to secure the area because they are so scared in case something happened. And what they think is most of them are the people who are doing the bad job. It's Saddam Hussein's followers. And they're still there around the areas. And I don't know how long it's going to take to be able to control that area. And then regarding the electricity, I thought, is it possible to send some generators since the flight started?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that a good option, or can they do that?
Well,
and some kind of generators to help the people with the electricity? And then regarding the trash all around Baghdad, there is people dying to work just to do some work so they can earn some money to get by.
Well, I'm not sure, Dr. Amowitz, if there's any part of that that you'd care to address.
Well, I think the security situation is an important one to discuss. One, because it is the responsibility of the occupying force, which is the coalition forces. And what has happened in particular to the medical sector is that doctors are not coming in for emergency operations overnight because of the security issues. And although we've had many discussions with some of the military forces on the ground, what we're always told is that it's a manpower issue. However, we know from Afghanistan and from other places that security should be the number one issue that has to be dealt with in order to move forward.
Well, Summer, thanks very much for sharing your family's observations, and we certainly wish them well.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate Bye-bye. That a lot. And Dr. Amowitz, you're returning tomorrow. Any idea of where you're going back to or what you're going to be doing?
We are hoping to be able to continue surveying in the southern regions to look at past abuses and some women's health concerns, since there's not a lot known about Iraqi women, and they need to have their voice represented, particularly when reconstruction is happening now.
Dr. Lynn Amowitz, thank you very much, and good luck on your visit.
Thank you.
Dr. Amowitz is a doctor with Physicians for Human Rights, and she was with us from her home in Providence, Rhode Island. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As we've heard any number of people say so far, security is a big problem in Iraq for both the Iraqis and for U.S. and British soldiers stationed there. Retired Marine Corps Colonel John Caldwell joins us now. He's a research fellow at the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities, a Marine Corps think tank. He just returned from an assessment mission to Iraq 2 weeks ago, and he's with us from his office in Quantico, Virginia. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon, Neil.
A lot of dire reports coming out of Baghdad. I understand, though, that you found the southern part of the country was more secure.
Yeah, I think by and large, it's very hard to talk about Iraq in one totality and summarize safety and security in just a few sentences. In general, in the areas where I visited in central Iraq and southern Iraq, things looked like they were beginning to improve. And by that, I mean people were walking in the streets, the kids were playing in the neighborhoods, and some of the shops were beginning to open for business, and people were starting to get on with their lives.
Well, where were you in particular?
I was in Al-Qut, Diwaniya and Al-Hilal, which is in the area around Karbala.
And these are all south of Baghdad?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Now, describe some of these areas that are unstable, particularly, I guess, to the north and west of Baghdad. We certainly hear an awful lot about Fallujah.
Right, and they're absolutely right to be concerned. You know, actually, the security situation is a double-edged sword. One is the security for the U.S. and coalition forces, and the other side, as we've heard earlier, is the security for the Iraqi people. So let me address the first part of that. And the kind of work that the military does basically just has some degree of risk in it. And even though the U.S. and the coalition forces are trying very hard to establish order, as we've heard, you know, there are some elements in Iraq that are trying to take action to create chaos. And so that makes it real tough for our young soldiers and Marines, who in many cases are asked to either stand in an open environment, manning checkpoints, guarding facilities, conducting urban patrols, and they simply don't know whether they're in a, quote, friendly environment or whether they're susceptible to attacks by rifle fire or rocket-propelled grenades. And so, consequently, for our young soldier or Marine, they're reminded of the old saying in the anti-terrorism business, the good guys have to be successful all the time, while the terrorist only has to be lucky once. And that makes their charter and their task particularly difficult.
Let's go now to Adil, who joins us from Los Angeles.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I think this gentleman just spoke was rightly explained the situation. There is two problems we have. One, the security. By the way, I was born in Baghdad, and I am a civil engineer. And the other is sanitation and water supply. The security, actually, like the gentleman said, it's really deal with this multi-ethnicity of Iraq. And there is only 5% of the Iraqi population in that triangle, Fallujah, Ana, Tikrit, is the case of problem. The rest is almost gladly see the American there. How the this triangular region still retain 50% of the armaments and the core elements of Saddam Hussein. This is the area that has to be eliminated. They probably have several hundred tanks underground and other armament and other military systems. So this has to be taken care of, and they are the troublemakers, and they are the ones who come in and disrupt the administration in improving the situation in Baghdad and other places west of Baghdad. As far as sanitation concerned, I had a project in Iraq in the 80s.
Could you make it very quick? We've just got a few seconds here.
The sewer system, the poisonous water supply in Baghdad and south of it was existing in the 80s.
Yes.
Because of the fact this is Saddam's system deliberately wanted to be neglected.
Okay, Adil, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop you there, but thanks very much for the phone call.
Okay.
We're going to continue talking about security with Colonel Caldwell after we come back from a break. We're also going to be talking about Iraqi oil. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, what really happens when teenage boys become fathers? A look at how they handle the responsibilities of parenthood. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about life in Iraq, what progress is being made towards reconstruction, and what new challenges are emerging. Our guest is John Caldwell, a research fellow with the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities, part of a team assessing security concerns in Iraq, if you'd like to join us in the conversation. And we're going to be taking up the question of Iraqi oil in just a few moments. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Colonel Caldwell, just before the break, a caller was describing the situation north and west of Baghdad. Can you characterize what's going on there? Are the attacks on American forces there sporadic, spontaneous even? How well is this organized?
Well, I don't have all the details because much of those intelligence is probably not available. We're still in the midst of trying to understand it, I suspect. But bottom line, as the speaker, the caller talked about, I think there are some elements of Saddam Hussein's Fedayeen that are still operating in some fashion, Republican Guard perhaps, and some of the foreigners. And in that regard, I think they are trying to organize in small cells, and that creates problems up north.
Mm-hmm.
Down south, the situation is a little different, and if we have the opportunity, I'd like to talk a little bit about that.
Why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, what we've done is ask our young soldiers and Marines to do a very difficult job. But for the Marines that were assigned, what they have done, is to assign basically battalion-sized units for managing several large cities in south-central Iraq. And the battalion commander, who's normally an officer with about 16 or 18 years of service, he's responsible for basically running the city and an extended region around there. Now, in the times that I was there, what it looked like he did was he assigned his subordinate units to different sectors, and these people dealt with Iraqi officials, religious clerics, the technicians, and security people from multiple layers every day. And then at night they had meetings to talk about logistics, engineering projects, and things that some of your other guests have talked about. So I think it's important for us, whether it's in the South or in the North, to be seen and to be perceived to be out in the neighborhood, you know, in a sort of a neighborhood watch concept. That's the only way you're going to get rid of this problem over time.
Now let's get another caller. Jennifer's on the line with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is about what's the difference in the availability of resources between the troops that are stationed in Iraq and other Americans, like journalists and the administration that's trying to put in the infrastructure, and Iraqi civilians. And I was wondering if there is a big difference in who gets electricity and clean water and sanitary conditions, and if that contributes at all to any feeling of resentment or bad feelings on the part of the people in Baghdad.
I think there certainly is an issue of allocation of resources, and I think that differs depending on where you are. In a larger sense, though, I think the caller is really talking about how we really need to take a regional and district approach and put out a vision for the road ahead so that people can know what the expectations are. We need to publicize it so that people in their area can focus on a goal and tell them what they need to do, because in the absence of a clear vision and guidance, we're really allowing some of the disruptive elements to pass their message to the populace. So beyond just the allocation of resources, I think the larger issue is to get a plan out there so that people can at least participate in it or improve on it.
When you talk about discrepancies, I mean, one that leaps to mind would be if generators, for example, are available, presumably they're in the hands of first the U.S. military.
Well, they are, but the military generally has their own generators so that they can keep their command posts working. I know that when I was there, what they had was every night, I mean, they would get down to details about how many trucks of fuel oil and gas needs to be at a certain place. They were getting the details of how many people needed to be evacuated, the amount of food that needed to be transported in. So there is a lot of effort. And I think it is pretty well coordinated. That's not to say that it's perfect. And, of course, when you have disruptive elements trying to participate in this process, it adds to the challenge. The other aspect is, you know, when you try to compare that even to us, I know that many people said, look, there's frustrations. The electricity's been out for a long, long time. But, you know, I'm reminded of the fact that sometimes in the East Coast when we have these hurricanes, there are people that are out of electricity for a week to 2 weeks at a time. So that's not to say that the situation is good, but it needs to be fixed, and it needs to be fixed quickly. I agree with that.
Okay, Jennifer. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Before we let you go, Colonel, I know that there are other problems. For example, how many translators, interpreters are there? Are there enough people to get back and forth to deal with the language problem?
I don't think so. I think it's very, very difficult because not only are there language barriers, there are cultural issues. And so what happens is, our Marines, in some cases, and in many cases, soldiers get briefings on it, but it's very hard to just put yourself in a different culture and a different society and know all the nuances. And so as long as we continue to work on it, I think it will improve, but that clearly is a challenge.
And those situations are also helped if you can keep the same troops in one place for a while. On the other hand, those troops want to come home.
Absolutely. Neighborhood watch.
Yep. Colonel Caldwell, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Retired Marine Corps Colonel John Caldwell, a research fellow at the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities, a Marine Corps think tank. He was with us from his office in Quantico, Virginia. In today's headlines here at NPR News, violence in the Middle East escalated today as a Palestinian suicide bomber on a bus killed at least 16 people. A short time later, an Israeli helicopter attack killed 7 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. On Capitol Hill today, the Senate is considering the nomination of Alabama Attorney General William Pryor to the Federal Appeals Court in Atlanta. Reports from NPR's David Wellner and NPR's Linda Gradstein, who's covering today's events from Jerusalem. Those stories later today on All Things Considered. As we return to our discussion about Iraq, the effort to rebuild that country has always hinged on one big factor: oil. Iraq sits on one of the largest oil supplies in the world, and that is expected to help pay the cost of reconstruction. Joining us now is Chip Cummins of the Wall Street Journal. He's been covering Iraq and its oil supply since the beginning of the year. He joins us now from his office in London. Good of you to stay up and be with us.
No problem. Nice to be here.
Iraq is rich in oil, but this resource can't help anybody if you can't get it out of the ground and into a pipeline and onto a ship and out of the country. The Iraqi oil ministry has been trying to restore production to at least half of its pre-conflict level of 2 million barrels a day by the middle of the month. I understand that's now been pushed back again.
Yeah, it's been pushed back a number of times, actually. The most recent, just 2 days ago. It seems that a lot of the optimistic forecasts that we saw in the very first days of the war, where the U.S.-led military invasion secured the oil fields or large sections of the oil industry just in the very first hours of the war, and reported back that, in fact, they were in good condition and expected to resume large-scale production and exports within a matter of months. As time went on, those predictions became, in fact, rosier as U.S. experts looked at wellheads and decided that, yes, in fact, we'd be able to go ahead and start pumping very soon. But in the chaos that that followed the fall of Baghdad, we've seen a huge reversal in that optimism. Wide-scale looting has set back reconstruction efforts dramatically. The Iraqis are extremely irate and very, frankly, very upfront about the scale of destruction that they've seen, not as a result of the war or sabotage by Saddam Hussein's troops, but in fact by the looting that has been allowed to take place since the war.
Yesterday, remarks by a senior British officer said it wasn't looting anymore. He described it as, what you just said, sabotage.
Well, I think there's probably a mixture of both. In the initial first days, I was in the South oil fields in just a few days after U.S. troops secured much of that territory, and you saw really just common criminals coming in and taking anything that wasn't tied down, air conditioning units that were stored in warehouses, cars, company cars for the South oil company, even small scale pumps, aluminum siding on buildings that can be sold as scrap. Now, however, though, U.S. officials and also Iraqi officials are saying more and more that there are signs that some of this is organized, and that, in fact, it's organized efforts at sabotage to embarrass the U.S.-led occupation forces and to embarrass the Iraqi officials who are working with those occupation forces. But I think it's a mixture of both, and I think it's extremely hard to figure out what exactly is going on, because you just don't have enough troops right now in these areas to say, hey, this is definitely what's happening. And more importantly, you don't have enough troops right now to protect against this, whether it's looting or sabotage.
Chip Cummins of the Wall Street Journal speaking with us from London. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller in. Roland joins us on the line from Los Angeles.
Well, hi, good morning. That's exactly what my girlfriend's brother, who's stationed over there, says, that that's what frustrates him in guarding the oil fields over there, that there is not enough troops. And that's the problem.
And what else does he tell you about what life is like over there?
Well, I have a feeling that he tells his sister that he is frustrated regarding the situation, that they need more troops over there
mm-hmm.
because of the safety issue.
Well, Chip Cummins, can you explain a little bit more about the problem? I mean, you know, these are very big areas, aren't they?
Yeah, they're huge areas. Even in Baghdad, and there's no, you know, significant oil infrastructure there. I'm talking more broadly. To patrol a city the size of Baghdad, you need a lot of people, and the U.S. military is just not planning on doing that, and right now isn't equipped to do that. Their job initially was to go in and seize the city and provide a minimum amount of security, troop security, force protection, as they call it, which they've done, and they've done a good job of. What they still need to do, though, is increase that presence, or hire or motivate the Iraqis to form some sort of security cordon, which they're doing in the oil fields.
So how could that be when they knew that they were going to have to secure the place after the war?
Well, I think you've seen some. I think you've seen U.S. officials recently admit that, in fact, it was a surprise the amount of looting, the amount of chaos, the amount of.
Sir, with all due respect, they allowed those people to loot. They let them do it right in front of their face. I mean, I don't understand that either.
Yeah, well, I'm not disagreeing with you, and there were precedents, conflicts. Certainly, like this before, have shown that when you invade a country, there is a level of chaos afterwards, and there is a level of looting. So you're absolutely right. There should have been a level of understanding and some sort of planning. The oil fields, however, are slightly different because they are so huge, and they're not an obvious target of crime like this or looting. These are pumps. For instance, some of these pumps that are being stolen weigh a ton, 2 tons. These are not things that you would think of would be the target of theft. But in fact, the very beginning, very first days of the occupation, you had petty criminals taking this away and selling them and making a profit and realizing, hey, this is a good business. And so it's just continued.
Now, what does all this mean for the timetable for production?
Well, it's turned back all sorts of timetables. The Iraqis are the most optimistic, and now they're saying by the end of this month they hope to be producing about 1.5 million barrels a day, which would allow for about 1 million barrels of exports. But everyone is taking that with a little bit of a grain of salt because of the reports of wide-scale looting. I mean, you have reports of entire pumping stations and warehouses being completely dismantled and razed, the aluminum siding being sold as scrap, the steel girders being dismantled and taken down and sold as scrap. So the level of destruction is something that I think is beyond the scale of what anyone anticipated, and that's certainly going to set back these timetables, even more so than probably the Iraqis are admitting at this stage.
Well, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Chip Cummins is a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal who has been covering the fate of Iraq's oil supply since the beginning of this year. We reached him in London. And in Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News. Thank you.